Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Ann W. Smith, co-chair of the club's member-led arts forum with Lynn Curtis. We also welcome our listeners on the radio, and we invite our audience to visit us online at thecommonwealthclub.org. This evening's program is a talk with Los Angeles Times reporter Jason Felch about his and co-author Ralph Ramolino's new book, Chasing Aphrodite, The Hunt for Looted Antiquities at the World's Richest Museum. Described as a, quote, dramatic tale of object lust, curatorial avarice, bribery, and deceit at the Getty Museum. Well, that was the publisher's line. Welcome home to San Francisco, Jason.
So nice to be home. Thank you for having me.
I understand you grew up here, and I see friends and family are present. And where's Ralph?
Ralph is in Bangladesh, where he now lives. He left the paper about 3 years ago and trains journalists in South Asia.
Uh-huh. Good. Well, things are happening in Bangladesh.
Yeah.
The first thing I'd like to know is a little biographical info for our audience. How did your career take you to the Los Angeles Times?
A long and winding path. I grew up here in San Francisco, went to college on the East Coast, and after college taught for 2 years in Ecuador.
What did you major in?
I majored in philosophy.
Okay.
Had notions of writing, but no idea how to do it. I came back to San Francisco, started an after-school program for refugee teenagers. Ran that for 4 years, a block away from here at the International Institute, was writing the whole time on the side, getting rejection letters from lofty magazines that I had no idea how to write for, and eventually decided, actually my wife helped convince me, journalism school made sense, so I went to Berkeley later than most do for a journalism master's, and was lucky enough after that to get a fellowship at the Center for Investigative Reporting, which used to be here and is now in Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
I did that for a year, worked with Lowell Bergman, who's at Berkeley and was a mentor for me, and then got a summer internship at the Los Angeles Times. That ended, I was hired on at the end of that, and my first day on the job was October 4th of 2004, and I walked in the door and put down my bag, and the investigative editor said, "Hey, Jason, come over here. We got a story that we need you to help with."
Wow.
The director of the Getty Museum just quit, and we have no idea why. It's the best museum job in the country, and she just walked out the door. Help us figure out what's going on up there. So that was about 6 years ago.
Wow. That was a leap.
Yeah.
That was wonderful.
Full circle.
My goodness, I had no idea that it wasn't, 20 years in the making before you got an investigative reporter's position. Chasing Aphrodite does uncover the story about a situation and events that caused, from the arts world's point of view, great consternation, angst, fear, and a little loathing. And I'm wondering how you want to just sort of summarize what kinds of, quote, antiquities is the Chasing Aphrodite investigation about? I know it's not about the Elgin Marble, so let's just leave that alone. And why were they so important to the Getty Museum and the rest of the art world?
It's nice of you to ask. I brought a little slideshow.
No.
Rather than me describing them, I thought I'd show you. J. Paul Getty was a passionate collector of art. He had five areas of focus of his collecting. One of them, and what became one of the most important ones, was ancient Greek and Roman art. It's a common area of collecting for people who really want to show that they're hot stuff, because it ties you directly with the greatest civilizations of Western civilization. So the Getty began late. It got its fortune really in the early 1980s, after Getty's death in 1976, and it went into the antiquities market and started trying to buy up the very best ancient art out there. Now, the market for ancient art is unlike any other type of art market because somewhat routinely, people stick a shovel in the dirt in their backyard in somewhere in the Mediterranean and uncover Picassos, Michelangelos, and the like. So masterpieces frequently just surface out of nowhere, and many of these ended up at the Getty Museum. The first and the title character of our book is this 7.5 foot tall limestone and marble statue of what at the time was believed to be the goddess Aphrodite, the goddess of love. She was made by students, really, of Phidias, the Greek sculptor who's best known for the Elgin marbles, for the Parthenon. His wet drapery style, the style that he perfected, really sent shockwaves throughout the ancient world as really an innovation in the way to display gods and goddesses. And so you can see what we have here is Greek colonists in southern Italy at the time, which was a Greek colony, were emulating this new style. This is probably made 30 to 40 years after what we sometimes call the Elgin marbles, and by students of Phidias. And it was an object of worship. It was something that would have sat in a temple to be revered by the local Greeks. It was bought by the Getty for $18 million in 1988, despite very clear signs that it had been recently excavated. You can barely make it out here, but that enormous 7.5 foot tall limestone body is broken rather neatly into three chunks, which if you've been in the antiquities world long enough, you know is a clear sign of smugglers needed to break it into bite-sized pieces so that it could get it out of the country. Those breaks are clean. They don't have the kind of patina that you would see in a piece that had been in the ground. So there are a lot of indications right when it surfaced that this piece was hot, recently excavated, and therefore a no-no. The Getty decided it couldn't pass it up, though. Oh, the reference, I'll just go back for a second. The reference, we know it's stolen, is to a 1987 memo in which Harold Williams, the CEO of the Getty Trust — the Getty has an umbrella organization called the Trust, and the museum is one program of the Trust — Harold Williams, the former head of the SEC, was debating whether or not the Getty could acquire objects like this with the museum director at the time, John Walsh. And one of the quotes in that memo that I rather am fond of is, "We know it's stolen. Are we willing to buy stolen property for some higher aim?" Well, the answer was yes, not just at the Getty, but at American mm-hmm. museums over the last several decades. Mm-hmm. This is the famous Kouros at the Getty. Any of you who have read Blink, you might remember this as the first chapter of that book. It's a...
By Malcolm Gladwell.
By Malcolm Gladwell, mm-hmm. yeah. It also features prominently in our book, Chasing Aphrodite. In fact, we break a little new ground in the often told story of the Kouros. This is almost certainly a fake. It was made to fulfill the needs of the Getty. The Getty had a desperate need to have a Greek life-size statue, and the Aphrodite met that need, and this piece was almost certainly created to fulfill that need by people in the illicit antiquities trade in Italy. It was fed into the Getty with the help of a corrupt curator named Jurgi Frel, who was eventually driven out. And it remains on display at the Getty, somewhat controversially. Marion True, the now famous curator at the Getty, concluded herself that this was almost certainly a fake. And yet there it is. The tag that is on display with the piece says, "Greek about 5th century B.C. or modern forgery."
Can't tell one from the other.
Right. You decide. This is another renowned piece. This is called the Getty Bronze. It's one of the very few remaining Greek bronzes. Most of these did not survive the ages. These were oftentimes, at one point or another, melted down into cannons or something. But this one survived because in the process of being pilfered by the Romans, who were looting the Greeks, it sunk to the bottom of the Adriatic Sea sometime around the time of Christ. There it sat for 2,000 years until some fishermen in 1964 were hauling their nets in and hit a snag. This is the opening chapter of our book. And what they pulled up was what you see in the bottom right, which is a barnacle-encrusted bronze statue. It was meticulously restored. All the barnacles were removed. And what emerged is possibly the only remaining work of Lysippus, the personal court sculptor of Alexander the Great. He was perhaps the best-known Greek sculptor of his era. He was best known for athletes like this one. This sculpture is also known as the Victorious Athlete. This very likely lined the pathway to Olympus. It was one of a dozen statues that lined the pathway as you walked into the Olympic Games, the original Olympic Games. This would have been a statue. He's crowning himself with an olive wreath, having just achieved some Olympic victory. This is the subject of an ongoing dispute between Italy and the Getty. It remains on display in a climate-protected room. It can't be exposed to normal temperatures or humidity because it will corrode, and has been meticulously cared for over the years by the Getty. But Italy wants it back, in part because it was smuggled out of Italy after the fishermen got it and showed up on the market in Europe in the 70s. This is the statue of Apollo. Around the 5th century BC, Greek, extremely rare to have original Greek statues like this. Most of the statuary that we know from this era are the Romans copying the original Greeks. So these are remarkable. For those of you who aren't familiar with the story in the book, essentially American museums collected these type of wonderful objects for decades, and there was kind of a wink and a nod system where they kind of knew these things had recently come out of the ground, but there was never any way to prove it. So they kept going, and the Italians would kind of rattle their sabers every now and then and say, hey, give that back, and the museums would laugh and say, we'll prove that it's looted. Well, in 1995... The Italians raided a warehouse in Switzerland of really one of the biggest middlemen in the trade, the man named Giacomo Medici, no relation to the older Medicis. Mm-hmm. What they found was a remarkable archive of looted antiquities, Polaroids, thousands of Polaroids showing incredible objects that had all come out of the ground in Italy or elsewhere, been laundered through this illicit antiquities trade, this kind of underground market, and popped up at museums not just across the United States but also across Europe and Japan and elsewhere. Those Polaroids led to the scandal that we ended up writing about in 2006. They really broke open the whole case. So I've included pictures of the Polaroids. They're not great pictures, but they really give you a visceral sense for what compelled the return of these objects. What you see is the Apollo on the floor on a packing crate very soon after it emerged from a tomb, having been illegally excavated. We know the backstory of this one now. It was illegally excavated from a tomb near Taranto, Italy, in kind of the southern heel of Italy. And here it is in all its glory. So when these Polaroids emerged, these are the things that really compelled the return of these objects to Italy. I'll go through somewhat quickly some of these other ones. These are really magnificent objects. There's nothing like these that exists anywhere else in the world. This is a lacanus, a ceremonial basin. Many of us forget that ancient marbles that we see today, pristine and white, all used to be very vividly painted, and all that paint is gone. So what we see is just the marble. But all of these things used to be incredibly painted with very lifelike coloration. You can see what remains of that. It's very rare to have this kind of paint remain on objects to this day. And here you see a little scene of Nereids, bringing the arms of Achilles, if you know the myth of the Trojan War, these fairies, these sea fairies, bring Achilles his weapon before he goes to battle. Mm. So here you see that scene depicted on this ceremonial basin that would have been used by ancient Greeks. Griffins attacking a fallen doe. This is the object that we used on our cover. There in the Polaroid, you can see the griffins in the trunk of a car. The Italians were able to find out that there's an Italian license plate in there. And then here's one of the griffins sitting on a piece of newspaper. Again, when you zoom in, you can tell it's an Italian newspaper. Mm-hmm. This is an incredible object, a golden wreath. It was found in the Royal Macedonian tombs, we later learned, likely sitting in the grave of a relative of Philip II of Macedon, Alexander the Great's father. So these were what Macedonian royalty were buried with. They were looted sometime in the early 90s in northern Greece, the Thessaloniki area, and smuggled through the black market to the Getty, where Marion True was presented with this object in 1993.
That's the curator.
Yeah, the Getty curator was presented this in 1993 in a Swiss bank vault by two men claiming to be Swiss collectors, but who curiously sounded like they had thick Greek accents. And she concluded, we know from her correspondence, that this was far too dangerous for the Getty to be involved with. Well, 3 months later, the Getty bought it. They couldn't pass it up. This is a beautiful Dionysus cup. Some of you who follow these things may have heard of Euphronius. Euphronius was the Michelangelo of Greek vases. He was the master painter, again, around the time of Aristotle, and was really the top of his field in terms of Greek vases are somewhat obscure, but they were, think of them like the painting canvases of their day. This is the what the master painters used to really show off their talent. And these objects were painted with glazes that oftentimes you couldn't see until they were fired. So imagine painting these type of objects blind and then having it fired later. This shows Dionysus on this elaborately handled drinking cup. This, again, would have been used in a ceremony for drinking wine. Kore is the female version of the Kouros. It's a woman, elaborate braids on her back. The photo you see on the right there was found in Giacomo Medici's warehouse. This also had been recently looted when this photo was taken. Here's an antifix. An antifix is a roof ornament from an Etruscan house. They had elaborate, beautiful, and beautifully painted ornamentation on their buildings. Here's the antifix moments after it came out of the ground. Somebody's propped it up and has kind of doused some water on it to wash off the dirt. Not just the Getty. Our book really focuses on the Getty, but whenever I speak about it, I feel it's very important to say this was an issue that affected a lot of American museums. This is something we wrote about as a local story in Los Angeles. The Getty was certainly a prominent player in this scandal, but the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York, the Boston Museum of Fine Arts, the Cleveland Museum, most American museums that collect ancient Greek and Roman art ended up getting linked to this controversy. And so you should not think of this as a provincial, oh, that crazy Getty Museum. They're so naughty down there. They're too rich. This is something that really pervaded the entire museum community. We're still seeing the fallout from this scandal to this day. There are two archaeologists who I've become very fond of whose job it is to sit in the basement of the Via Giulia in Rome, an Etruscan museum in Rome, and basically take all these thousands and thousands of Polaroids and meticulously comb through all the known catalogs of the world, museums, and make matches. So it's kind of, imagine it like a giant game of concentration. They're basically matching the loot to the museum display cases, and when they find matches, we hear about it. So you will continue to hear about it. There is a whole other dealer, a man named Gianfranco Bacchina, who Italian law enforcement authorities say rivaled Medici for the scope of his involvement in illicit antiquities trade. His archives now is starting to become public. We are going to hear more about this, and most likely more objects will eventually go back. Just a few examples. This is the Euphronius crater. This scene is of Sarpedon, the son of Zeus. His dead body is being taken off the battlefield at Troy by sleep and death. This is perhaps the most important Greek vase known to man that has survived antiquity. It was painted by the guy Euphronius that I mentioned before. It really is an exquisite masterpiece. It is no longer on display at the Met. It has been returned to Italy, and it will now go back and forth between Italy and the Metropolitan every 4 years as part of the resolution of this scandal that we've written about. Here's another Greek vase. You can see the before Polaroid and the after on display at the Met. Also, the Boston Museum of Fine Arts, just as another example. Here's their beautiful statue of Sabina. Sabina was the wife of Emperor Hadrian. And below, you see Sabina sitting on some packing crates soon after she came out of the ground. You can see she's got some damage. She's a little dirty. They cleaned her up. This is the last slide. This is an organization chart that was found by Italian police. And it's very hard to make out if you don't know the names, but I'll tell you basically what it is. This is a diagram of the illicit antiquities trade in Italy. What you have at the bottom are the looters, guys all across Italy, the boot of Italy, who were digging in the fields, and the middlemen who kind of consolidated what they found. These were funneled up through, there's Gianfranco Bacchina, and there's Giacomo Medici. These were the two most prominent middlemen, both based in Switzerland. They both gave their objects to Robert Hecht, a lovely 92-year-old gentleman. Really, if there is an Indiana Jones out there, it's him. He's classically trained, but he decided to go to the dark side.
And
has been supplying American museums with their best ancient art for years. And right at the top, what you see is who Heck's clients were. You see Paris, he sold off into the Louvre, and USA, you see museums and collectors. This is one of those diagrams that really tells you how sophisticated what started off as kind of a trade in trinkets after World War II really grew into a very sophisticated global supply chain of looted antiquities from graves and tombs around the Mediterranean to a museum near you. That's it.
That's amazing.
There's the book in 10 minutes.
There's the book. Well, there's a lot.
There's much more. You should definitely buy it.
A lot of great stories. Definitely. Yeah. I highly recommend it. There's a lot of wonderful sections that talk about the various personalities and their interaction. It's really a fascinating read. I was intrigued by the whole situation through the point of view of the Getty Museum as a new museum. I remember attending the opening and pre-opening of the museum itself. Have people been there? Yeah, and it's one of the most beautiful homes for art that you could ever see. There's the two buildings, the museum on the hill with the wonderful, is it travertine marble with the fossils that's the skin of the building, and then the villa, which was renovated, that this curator, Marion True, was given the task of supervising the renovation in part as a reward for her loyal searches and negotiations relating to some of the antiquities that were going to be placed in the villa. The other part is not about so much about antiquities. But one of the questions we always had, I think, in the arts world was, you know, the homes were sort of superior to the furniture in many ways. And the Getty was in a great hurry to get these pieces in and get them filled. And I often wonder if there had not been such a hurry, if all of this might have been avoided or never discovered.
They should have been listening to you, Ann. Don't rush.
Okay.
It'll only get you in trouble.
Take your time.
No. This is your advice to the Getty.
So to me, that's about the organizational culture. And what your findings were about that, I wonder.
Yeah, I mean, I think you put your finger on it. The Getty came into enormous wealth in 1981 after all the litigation over J. Paul Getty's will. J. Paul Getty died in 76 and left essentially all of his personal fortune, not to his five sons or to his various wives or anybody like that.
You mean $100 million?
$700 million.
Okay.
$700 million he left to what at the time in 1976 was a very provincial, not very visited, relatively small Getty Museum on the Pacific Coast Highway just outside of Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. It became overnight the world's richest museum. And we have these great documents of these meetings where they say, what the hell do we do with all this money?
Right.
Build the collection. I mean, they had a pretty mediocre collection at the time, and so they suddenly had come into enormous amounts of wealth. And so they said, you know, we want to be the best at something. We've got to be the best at something with this much money. And really one of the very few places in collecting that they could try to make a mark. I mean, at this time in the early 80s, a lot of the big collections had already been built. There had been an enormous turnover of art for various reasons during World War II and all the ensuing turbulence. But by 1980, it was very hard to come by old masters, right, which is really the measure by which we think of measuring museums. So the Getty wasn't going to be a great paintings museum. It just was too late for that. So antiquities offered this wonderful opportunity to really be the best at something. Because in antiquities, like I said, Michelangelo's would come out of the ground every few years. So this was recognized early on, and there was a plan hatched that we would build this palace on a hill, what became the Getty Center in 1997, and we would transform our old museum, this villa on the coast, into a specialty museum only about Greek and Roman antiquities. In order to accomplish that goal, which was really kind of a founding goal of the organization, they decided that they had to really buy a lot of stuff. Their first move was to go to their best antiquities dealer, this guy Jerry Eisenberg in New York, and say, we'll take everything you have. I don't care what it costs, just give us everything because we just need stuff. And that's kind of the approach they took. They would just go out there and they had top dollar. They could just go out into the world and buy stuff. This got them an enormous amount of trouble. It didn't save other organizations like the Metropolitan, which has been collecting antiquities for decades, from getting in the same kind of trouble. But it got the Getty deepest into trouble.
Mm-hmm. 'Cause it was the most intense.
And there is a certain nouveau riche feeling where you kind of want to make your mark quick, and mm-hmm. you want to compete with the old blue buds on the East Coast.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I was intrigued by the relationships as you trace them among the board, the director, the curatorial staff, the administrative staff. What was that culture like from what you were able to evolve? I mean, you unearthed amazing. Why did these people? Oh, I always wonder, why do these people keep all these notes and records in their folders? I just, as an administrator, I was really curious.
Yeah, yeah. This is one of those. There were several meetings where like, don't take notes of this meeting.
Yeah,
they
I
took
would say
notes.
So.
Thank God. Well, we don't know the meetings they didn't take notes in, but thankfully we have a lot of notes from the meetings they did take notes in. And what you see over the period of several years is an institution profoundly wrestling with this dilemma, the compelling need that they saw to build the collection, and a real awareness from the very beginning that the antiquities trade is the dark, dirty corner of the art market. This is where the dirty stuff happens. All the dealers involved were basically criminal, associated with the criminal underground. They were people that had strong ties to the looters. There were plenty of hints along the way that the mafia and other organized crime groups had their hands in some part of this trade. And so accomplishing this goal they had set for themselves was laying down with lions. And so mm-hmm. So what you see in these meetings over time is very highly educated people. These are Harvard PhDs and leading scholars in their area wrestling with something that they know is wrong in some ways, that mm-hmm. is both puts them in extreme legal jeopardy, and the public found out about it, would be pretty unhappy about, mm-hmm. and yet they felt compelled to do it. Now, it's worth asking from an institutional point of view, what's the mission of the Getty?
Mm-hmm.
Is the mission of the Getty to have the best antiquities collection in the country? No, the mission of the Getty was vaguely written, but it was to diffuse knowledge. It was to educate the public. And so I think if you want to analyze it from an institutional point of view, you have to go back and think, why did they decide that their path forward had to be build the big splashy building and fill it with the best stuff no matter what?
In the name of educating the public.
In the name of educating the public. And the thesis of our book, really, if there's a core argument in our book, it's that the Getty and other American museums have betrayed their core mission. Their core mission is to educate us, to enlighten us, to not just show us pretty things, but to tell us what those pretty things mean and where they came from and who made them. And by engaging with the illicit antiquities trade, museums really betrayed that mission to educate us and basically sacrificed truth in the pursuit of beauty. So they got a lot of pretty things. We know very, very little about these pretty things. The Statue of Aphrodite, which we write about, is kind of the central character in our book. There's plenty of human beings in the book, too. But mm-hmm. in terms of art, we know nothing about her. During her 23 years at the Getty Museum, no scholar studied her. The Getty itself basically completely ignored her. There was none of this kind of who made this, why was it made, what purpose did it serve. That was off limits, because if you went down that path, you'd quickly find out that it had been looted. So in essence, what you have is these kind of mute objects of beauty. And that's one way in which these objects are valuable. They are beautiful objects, but it is a shadow of really their whole thing, which is these are incredibly important historically and can tell us a lot about the ancient world.
So that was why it was so important to the museum, to the Getty and the others, to get these objects, as it were. The management principles involved, how much were the executive directors involved? There weren't really that many up until everything fell apart. But what was the – you had the board. Everybody seemed to have been lured in some way. And this happens with nonprofit and arts boards of different stripes from time to time. into doing something that they would not engage in their workday life. But the board members as volunteers, the executives, of course, were very well paid.
Enormously well paid, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I think one of the reasons we felt the need to do this book after having reported on the Getty for the LA Times for 2.5 years was that there was parts of the story that hadn't been told or who hadn't been completely told or well told in the newspaper, in large part because of the kind of limitations of the form.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of those stories was just the full extent that Marion True, the curator who recommended the purchase of these objects, became the focus of a lot of the controversy. She was the one that was indicted by Italy. She was the one that was asked to stand trial. One of the things we really wanted to show with these documents that we were able to get is that Marion True, did what she did, but she did it with the approval of the associate director of the museum, the director of the museum, the CEO of the foundation, and the board of trustees, all of whom were in the loop, and we kind of go out of our way to document the fact that they all knew that this was going on, and this was a decision made as an institution, not as an individual. She was not a rogue curator operating out in the wild some ways. She was very much doing what she was being ordered to do all the way up at the chain of command. And it's a really important question. What compels so many leading people? I mean, the chairman of the board at the Getty during a period of controversy where a lot of kind of misspending and egregious misuse of nonprofit resources was a man named John Biggs. John Biggs had run TIAA CREF, the Teachers Retirement Fund. He was a board governance guru. He was a man who testified before Congress during Sarbanes-Oxley about the right way to prevent these kind of scandals. And here he was at the Getty Museum presiding over an enormous spending controversy where the CEO, Barry Munitz, essentially ran wild with the Getty's resources and used it to line his own pockets and make friends in Hollywood and British royalty.
And Barry Munitz was the former head of the California State University system.
Where he also had a track record.
These things may follow you.
So how does John Biggs, who's a corporate governance guru, make the decision, as we reported first in the LA Times and again mentioned in the book — it's not the focus of the book — but his job as the chairman of the board audit committee was to approve the expenses of Barry Munitz. Well, Barry Munitz was flying himself and his wife around the world first class and renting Italian vacation villas with friends on the Getty dime. And the chairman of the board was approving those expenses. So why'd you approve that, Mr. Biggs? Well, Mr. Biggs says, well, actually, I delegated that to Munitz's deputy. So that was not a wise choice in hindsight. You shouldn't have the boss's deputy approving the boss's expenses. But John Biggs couldn't be bothered to do the paperwork. And so, I mean, it's a human story. These are the decisions we make that we later.
They're very ironic.
Yeah.
The level of management doesn't always indicate the quality of management. I'm wondering in going through with this investigation, did you find places where you needed to stop and say, okay, we can't go any farther with this for whatever reason, ethical, moral? What was off limits? That's my hardball question.
That's your hardball? Okay. Not much. We try not to pull punches. I mean, our job is really to kind of, without fear or favor, write what we know. The kind of issues we deal with are source protection issues. Sometimes we know something, but if we told you that we know it, it would be very clear who we're talking to. And so we need to protect the people that are helping us
deal with it.
And that gets complicated. One of the things journalistically that happened with this story is that a lot of the people we were talking to in the beginning, the first in the newspaper series of stories, really from 2005 to 2007, it began about misspending of nonprofit resources by Barry Munitz. And there were a lot of people at the institution who were very unhappy with Munitz and shared information with us that allowed us to pin this down and get beyond he said, she said. Those people turned out to be pretty deeply implicated in the antiquities problem, and we found out about that later. And so here were people that had trusted us and who we had trusted, and then we found out that they had some problems. And some people that, you know, had been on the bad side in the beginning turned out to be very helpful at the end. So things get topsy-turvy when you report on an institution over 3 years You know, at the end of the day, I think pretty much everybody ended up talking to us, with the exception, I should say, of Marion True.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, wrestling with those kind of issues, I mean, if you're ever being investigated by an investigative reporter, your best move is to become a source. Because if you're a source,
yep. Co-optation.
They got to protect you, right? I mean, this goes back to all the president's men.
Mm-hmm.
So that puts us in a tricky position because we have to choose very carefully who we give that protection to, and then when we retract that protection and say, there's a tough story coming, and it's about you.
And so then you attempt to co-opt the situation in some way.
We're always trying to co-opt.
But if I'm being investigated, I want to figure out how I can co-opt what's going on.
You want to get a box of documents
and
invite me to coffee and say, I have some important information to share with you.
And go ahead and publish it. does the newspaper, the LA Times, did they ever try to tell you to back off of certain things? How did politics and cultural policy and, you know, government and corporate stuff get in the way here? Because it seemed to be floating through but not making a big splash.
Right. So I was very green, as I said, when I first got onto the story at the LA Times. I was literally a brand new reporter at the LA Times and had only been doing journalism for a year or two or three. We were picking a fight with one of the most powerful cultural institutions in Los Angeles. The just retired chairman of the board was Bob Herbaru, who was a senior executive at Times Mirror Company, which owns the LA Times. We were calling Mr. Herbaru's, we're on the third floor in the LA Times building. Mr. Herbaru's on the fifth floor. So we would find ourselves walking upstairs saying, Mr. Herbaru, why did you approve this? Mr. Herbaru, why? And, you know, that, you know, Mr. Herbaru said, who the hell are you and what are you doing here? The first thing that the Getty, when we finally got a chance to kind of talk to the Getty and say, hey, this is what we've been finding and we want to talk to you about it, their first move was to call the publisher of the Times Mirror Company, who was old friends with the new chairman of the board, and, you know, make these pests go away. They don't know what they're talking about, and I happen to be working with two other somewhat young reporters, and these kids don't know what they're doing. You're way out on a limb. You're going to get burned by this. Come on. You know, so... as is true in San Francisco and in most cities, at the top of all the leading cultural organizations is the board of trustees, and there's like, you know, 15 people, and they're all friends with each other and play golf or tennis. And so that's who we were.
Mm-hmm. And make contributions to political leaders as well.
Absolutely. So to the institution's credit and to my enormous satisfaction, the editor and the managing editor of the LA Times at the Times were two of the most hardcore pro-investigative journalism editors, John Carroll, now retired, and Dean Baquet, now managing editor at the New York Times. These are hard-charging guys. They were not going to back down.
Right.
And they said, ignore all that. We'll deal with it. You do your job. And it was kind of, you know, I was never told no.
That's the kind of boss you want.
It really is, and they're no longer with the LA Times, so I miss them.
they took buyouts as well.
That was like six editors ago. Yeah.
Oh, dear. the fast-moving world these days of management, reporting, and media of all kinds is really a different world than when you started in the early part of this century, very early part of the century. I'm wondering what your reflections are about, before we get to questions from the audience, I'm wondering what your reflections are about collectors and international cultural policy. We've seen instances in the past couple of years, at least, of concerns over antiquities and looting of antiquities in other parts of the world. And... for example, with Iraq and the Baghdad museum there, and there was great sound and fury from the museum world, you know, and also in Egypt, where early winter, people went to guard the museum and prevent the looting. So, is it something that's going to always be with us, this desire to go get the stuff in the museum?
You've seen a really remarkable cultural change in the American museum community around this issue just in the last 5 years. And we're always clamoring for change to be immediate and tomorrow. And smarter people that we talk to remind us that these type of changes really take time, and that actually the changes that have gone on in the American museum community have been relatively quick on this issue. So since really 2005, when these scandals were kind of hitting the front pages all around the world, American museums have, by and large, stopped collecting looted, I would say, Greek and Roman antiquities. They're being very careful. The Association of Museum Directors, that kind of sets the tone, has kind of put out a new dictate saying, look, there's a bright line at 1970, and just don't mess with it. And you know, they really only needed one curator to be tried to kind of get the message.
But not convicted.
Tried but not convicted. Mm-hmm. The charges expired. That said, so that's remarkable and it's really impressive, and,
yes.
and American museums should be commended for making that turn. There's a young generation of museum directors who really understand this issue and understand that the old way of doing business is no longer acceptable. That's exciting to see. With that said, our real focus here was Greek and Roman.
Mm-hmm.
After the series wrapped up, I caught wind of another controversy involving some very similar situations, Southeast Asian art. The federal agents in 2008 raided four Southern California museums and uncovered a smuggling network of Thai antiquities being smuggled into the country, donated to LACMA, the L.A. County Museum, mm-hmm. The Pacific Asia Museum in Pasadena, and several other museums, had inflated, basically at kited appraisals. This was a tax fraud scheme, looted antiquities. And this is something that happened at the Getty
in the
early 80s. It was going on in 2008, and it was looted Southeast Asian antiquities. So I don't think the problem is over. I think that the Greek and Roman network has essentially been taken down, coupled with the Italian investigation and the museums kind of really being sensitized to it. But look at the pre-Columbian art in your local museum. Look at the Southeast Asian art. Look at the Middle Eastern art. This Iraqi material that was looted in the period after the war has yet to really surface on the art market. It's probably sitting in a warehouse in Jordan cooling off until everybody stops talking about Iraq. And you're probably going to see some local museum build a new Iraq wing or a new, you know, they're going to call it Sumerian or something. But, you know, this stuff will surface. And if we stop asking the questions, I think we'll see the practice come back. That's my fear, at least.
Well, the fact that people keep repeating themselves in history.
We tend not to learn.
And we tend not to remember it all. This is the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Ann W. Smith, co-chair of the Member-Led Arts Forum. And you're listening to a conversation with Jason Felch about his and co-author Ralph Remolino's new book, Chasing Aphrodite, The Hunt for Looted Antiquities at the World's Richest Museum. I'm hoping we have some questions. I wanted to say to Jason that when I first began to think about this panel and approach reading the book, I had too much on my mind, the investigative reporting that comes across on cable television and it was just, and how, you know, kind of disgusting it is. And so I was looking at, oh dear, another investigative report. But I have to say, this is a really good book. It's really good writing. It's balanced. It is fair and balanced, believe it or not. And it never goes over the edge. Well, maybe one or two sentences of the drama of the mystery. So, do we have any questions from the audience?
Please, I encourage
walk up to
balls.
The microphone, and he likes tough questions. So.
Well, I don't know if it's so tough, but you talked about after the Second World War, the growth of this acquiring and the money involved. But for centuries, conquerors and explorers had been pilfering these things and taking them home and altering them and so forth. Can you make a judgment of this case over time? What made this so much exponentially worse, or is it just a matter of time and money that makes it this one more severe?
It's an important question. We make a joke in the prologue of our book. We say looting is the world's second oldest profession. looting has always been around. The earliest known legal document is a trial of looters in ancient Egypt. And the looters had been caught breaking into a pyramid and had been caught looting. So this issue has been around and with us forever. And for many, many years, certainly from the Enlightenment, when a lot of our modern museums kind of trace their roots to Diderot's encyclopedia and this notion that museums are a collection of cultures all in one place, taking other people's culture through by whatever means has been a part of that process. Whether it be through war or through conquest or what have you. What really changed is that in 1970, the United Nations got together the world's biggest countries, both source countries, countries that are archaeologically rich, and collecting countries like the United States and Great Britain, and said, look, this looting has gotten out of control. Really, after World War II, it exploded, and archaeological sites were just being destroyed. And they said, we've got to put an end to this. We need to create illicit trade, one that's legal, and stamp out this illicit trade. So that was the it has a very long and complicated name, but we call it the UNESCO Treaty of 1970. Mm-hmm. That was really a bright ethical line in the sand. From now on, we're not going to do that anymore. From now on, we're going to try to, buy and trade these things, respecting each other's patrimony laws and honoring attempts to protect these sites. So there are the Elgin Marbles being the most prominent one, but there are a lot of historical claims that get very murky where you have conquest and change of government and objects of art changing hands multiple times, and they get very murky and they're kind of ethically confusing. Mm-hmm. And in the book, we try to make a clear distinction and say after 1970, there was really at very least a very clear ethical change. And then the law quickly evolved after that to basically make it pretty clear under American law, under Italian law, under Greek law, you couldn't really be doing this stuff. And so our book focuses on this period after that bright line of 1970, mm-hmm. and basically between 1970 and today, when finally we're really honoring the spirit of UNESCO, it's just taken us 4 years.
It's how, sometimes cultural policy takes forever to evolve. And this is a good example, I think, of an international cultural policy that is attempted for literally now decades to be enforced by the countries that embrace the principles of UNESCO and of cultural policy. This side.
Hi, I'm looking forward to reading the book. Two-part question. First, the Getty, because of its record keeping, was probably very easy to kind of get more information about their records and things like that, just because they're a big target. But I'm wondering if you thought about investigating the things that never make it into a museum, the private collectors who are driving this as well. That's the first part of the question. Yeah. And then with the arrival of Jim Kuno as the president of the Getty Trust, he's written kind of an expert on this material now too. Any thoughts about his arrival and what that means for the Getty?
Yeah. Good questions. To your first question, the Getty was by no means easy to penetrate. They keep lots of records, but like most arts organizations in the United States, they're private. Mm-hmm. And aside from the 990 that they file with the tax authorities every year, they have no obligation and really have no reason to share any information, especially not with investigative reporters. So virtually all the documents we got were leaked to us. There's almost no public record information in the book because there's really not much public record information about arts organizations. This is a problem, and I would say this is a big picture problem with arts organizations and nonprofits in general. They need to work to be more transparent. And because of the tax code, that's going to have to be a voluntary process. Private collectors are even less transparent, right? Private collectors are just private individuals mm-hmm. who buy whatever they want and keep it in their living room. Thankfully, there are some incentives for them to publish their collections. So a number of prominent private collectors got swept up in this scandal. Private collectors, a lot of them, end up donating their collection to a museum. And so that's a transaction that generates records and hopefully some amount of research into where do these things come from. And that turns up stories.
And the IRS steps in.
Very rarely. We did a whole dig into the art appraisal services of the IRS, which if you're nerdy and curious one day, go on their website. It's fascinating. They generate these annual reports that no one ever reads, where they basically take a sampling of the art market every year, and they get leading appraisers to appraise the objects that are being donated for tax write-offs. Well, every year since we went back 20 years, every year about 80% of the objects being donated, whether it be to museums or other institutions, are dramatically over, you know, their appraisals are inflated. Maybe it's because these appraisers that the IRS is leaning on are too conservative. Well, when you look at death benefits, estate tax, I have an accountant here in the audience, so I'm being careful to get this right. When you look at the estate tax, the incentive there is to undervalue an object, not overvalue it, right? Well, sure enough, objects time and time again are being undervalued. So the IRS is not a very good watchdog. In the United States, it's the only watchdog, really, them and the Attorney General who oversees nonprofits and keeps them in line. We don't have a Ministry of Culture in this country, so there's no authority figure who really regulates the art world. It's one of the bigger kind of dark markets out there. Your second question was about Jim Cuno. For those who don't know, Jim Cuno used to, has for years been at the Art Institute of Chicago, and really made a name for himself on this issue of antiquities. He is one of the most outspoken proponents of basically freewheeling collecting, the right of museums to buy what they want. He has argued passionately against the national patrimony laws of countries like Italy, saying that these are nationalistic. He often points out that Italy's law was written in 1939 under Mussolini. Actually, it predates Mussolini, but it was modified that year. So he is really one of the leading pro-collecting voices out there in the world. It's become a very lonely role in the last 5 or 6 years because these scandals have really, I think, shown that by defending, he defends it on philosophical grounds mostly, but by defending it on philosophical grounds, you're kind of sanctioning a black market and fueling a black market. Mm-hmm. It's been a harder position for him to maintain. Suddenly, he's also a very prominent scholar in his area and a very well-respected arts administrator. The Getty, since its CEO passed away unexpectedly a few years ago, James Wood, hired Jim Cuno to be its new director. So here you have an organization that recently has become the leading reformer in this world, that basically was outed and suffered more than most, dramatically turned around and said, we're going to adopt a very tough antiquities policy. We're going to bully our fellow museums to be tough on this and really be smart and progressive on this issue. And now they've hired what some would consider the most regressive CEO in the country. It's going to be very interesting what happens when he said time and again, I'm not going to change our policy and I'm not going back to the old way of doing things. But it's really hard to wonder why the board chose him of all people if this weren't somewhere in their mind. It's a wait-and-see situation. They have to hire a museum director, a position that's been open for the last year. And I wouldn't rule out more scandals coming out of the Getty in the future.
Okay, next question.
I, too, look forward to reading your book. And I guess it's a good follow-up to your or what you were just saying, because as a person who spent, I'd say, close to the last decade of my life at the East Coast Institution that you mentioned earlier, studying art history. I mean, there is, I'll pose the question, what is private collection is quite different, but in terms of museums and institutions that are well equipped to preserve those art objects, and clearly you mentioned the Elgin marbles, I mean, many fewer people would have seen them had they not been at the British Museum. And so, yes, well, the Getty is a nouveau-riche, like, riche institution. It is certainly, with $700 million, well-equipped to preserve these art objects. And as someone who has many peers who are in, you know, Sotheby's and Christie's and auction houses, I would say that is there a real, I mean, while one does not want to advocate stealing, I am very much on the same side as Cuomo, and I understand why they would choose him as a director.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if our purpose is to, you know, help the public and, you know, to make these objects accessible to them,
right,
then aren't the best institutions or places for them to live museums, and the better ones in the world at that?
Mm. Right. A provocative question. What you're articulating, and I'm not trying to pick on you, but you're articulating the counterpoint, and it's in the book. I've been talking about the other side of the coin, but the pro-collecting point of view is kind of what you articulate. It's, you know, these objects have already been looted. They're now floating around in the market. What better institution than the now $5 billion endowed Getty, mm-hmm. with some of the best conservators in the world? What better institution is there to take care of these masterpieces? They have state-of-the-art facilities. They have, you know, they're just wonderfully equipped. And at the Getty Villa, which is the smaller of the two Getty museums, 400,000 people a year go to it. Right. You can argue about whether they're going there for the art or not, but they're there and they might see the art while they're there. So shouldn't that count? Shouldn't that isn't that a good reason for them to have those things? This is the debate. I mean, I have an opinion. I have a point of view. It comes out in the book. I mean, and it comes not from knowing anything about this before investigating it, but from seeing the consequences of that ethos. The consequence of that ethos is a fueling of a black market that is incredibly mm-hmm. destructive of the archaeological record, and ultimately that does not do these institutions much good. As a museum goer, a somewhat naive museum goer, when I go to a museum and I see the Kouros, you know, I get a placard with like 100 words on it. And I don't, you know, for me to engage with this work of art, maybe it's because I'm kind of more in my head, but I want to know about it. I want to know who made it and why. And we lose that whole story when we get these things that way. And so for me, it's, and when you go to American museums, you know, you'll see Van Gogh's Irises at the Getty, a wonderful painting. Mm-hmm. There's a long story about what Van Gogh was thinking when he painted it, and et cetera, his whole body of work. We don't have those for ancient art. We know almost nothing, and it's because it was a long time ago, but it's also because these things came through this kind of laundry. And so it's a worthy debate to have. I don't think the debate is over. You have a harder case to make these days, mm-hmm. because there are very clear ties between what you're advocating and a black market that involves breaking the law. And a lot of people are getting in trouble because of that. So what you see emerging, thankfully, is a kind of a third path, where people with your belief system, which I certainly empathize with, and I you know, there are parts of me that kind of see it through your eyes, say, you know, this stuff should be at the Met. You know, mm-hmm. how many people go to the Met every year? Like, the Met should have the great stuff out there. It shouldn't have the rinky-dink stuff. Well, what's emerged from this whole controversy is this kind of new era that we call kind of moving beyond ownership. Italy has some of the best ancient art in the world. It rarely leaves Italy. Well, that's wrong. That stuff should be traveling, right? That stuff should be at the Met. The Met has great stuff that sits in the basement and never gets anywhere. Well, the Met should share it with the Akron Museum. You know, I mean, the Akron Museum would love that stuff.
It's a good museum.
So there's starting to be a kind of replacing this ownership culture where we get it illegally, we hide it for a few years to let it cool off, and then we kind of put it out on display with no information and hope we don't get caught. You're starting to see a change where there's a lot more sharing. Jim Cuno did this at the Art Institute of Chicago very successfully with India. You're starting to see collaboration between these different countries and collecting museums and sharing. There's no shortage of this material to go around. There's a shortage of kind of dialogue and a mechanism for sharing it. And I'm gratified. We didn't know we were going to have a happy ending of the book, but I'm gratified to say that there is kind of a happy ending for the book. And it's this ethos of sharing and collaboration has really emerged from this really painful mm-hmm. scandal. And I hope that's the way we go, because that would satisfy your point of view and my point of view in terms of, you know, not destroying our knowledge of the ancient world, but, gee, these things are pretty and we're really well equipped to show them off. Can't they come here?
That would be very productive.
Very productive possibilities then. Let's have the question here and then one last question.
Well, it looks like there was no law until 1970. And now there is law, but there is also gray area. There is law, legal, there is illegal, and then there is ethical and maybe not so ethical. And museum curators, it's a probably pretty old profession, and a lot of professions have some kind of a code. Is there some kind of a code that applies to museum profession, something like do no evil, that Google, for example, proclaims.
Yeah,
there is a code.
There's two big museum kind of governance bodies. There's the it's called the AAMD, the American
Association of Museum
Directors. They're kind of the elite. Those are the kind of big institutions like the Philadelphia and the Met, the Boston, the Getty. And then there's a much broader kind of all museums umbrella, the AAM, the American Association of Museums. Both of these institutions, as a product of this controversy, have adopted strict new regulations, which basically say it's not enough to respect the law or to look like you're respecting the law. You have to be ethical about it, and here's how. And I would encourage you to go look at those guidelines. They're pretty impressive.
Yeah, they are.
And they basically say, you know, don't be evil.
We have time. We have time for one last question, which is, please be good. No.
Oh no, I wouldn't say that.
30 seconds.
One thing I'm trying to understand. So there's more cooperation going on and
yes.
potentially more sharing. Is there study going along with that sharing? So as you say, we get to learn about these pieces and where they're coming from and how they're made and all that. Because frankly, that's really what I'm interested in.
Yeah, it's a fascinating mm-hmm. area. There's this whole actually new area of scholarship. And they have a fancy name for it that I won't recall right now. But it's essentially, there's all these objects that were illegally excavated and are now either being returned or being kind of recognized as looted. Well, can we go back and reconstruct, retrospectively, something of that object's history? Can we find out where it was excavated? Can we talk to the looters? Can we track it through the illicit market and learn about its origins and what might have been found with it? And through that process, understand, kind of rebuild the lost context. It's a fascinating area. It's one I've spent a lot of time on because that's kind of what we've been doing is kind of recreate this history, this middle history. And it's being taken very seriously by scholars. Most importantly and most notably with the title piece, Aphrodite, it's now back in Sicily, a stone's throw from the archaeological site where it was looted. And scholars, not just Italian scholars, but especially Italian scholars, are in the process of saying, you know, this isn't Aphrodite. This is probably Persephone. And she was an object of cult worship, and try to recreate that history. That's promising. These things are now being studied, and they were kind of ignored for a long time.
Thank you. Our warmest thanks to Jason Felch, and thanks to our audience today and our radio audience. And now, with great thanks to you, Jason, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 108th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.
Thank you so much.